Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
You'd be hard-pressed to find an actor working today who is more beloved than today's guest. Since the early 1970s, he has been making a name for himself in film, television, and theater. Lots and lots of indelible theatrical productions whose runs were all enhanced by the talents of today's guest.
Here is just a small sampling of his theatrical works. All right, get ready. Godspell, the original productions of Sweeney Todd, Death Trap, Noises Off, Lend Me a Tenor, Assassins and Art, revivals of Hello Dolly, Present Laughter, Damn Yankees, Little Me, and so many more.
I think that's just like a third of the times this person's appeared on stage. To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Philip Bosco, Uta Hagen, Marianne Seldes, Dorothy Loudon, Mildred Dunnock, Tammy Grimes, James Coco, Stephen Sondheim, Gilda Radner, Tom Stoppard, and so many more. Here is the man who has played both God and the devil, Victor Garber. Victor, how are you today?
I'm exhausted hearing how long I've been doing this and what I've done, but I'm great. I'm very
It's quite
great
a list.
To be here.
Yeah,
we are happy to have you. Now, I hate to put you on the spot like this, but I'm going to ask.
No, you don't. No,
I do.
No, that's out why
of, he knows you already, Rob.
Out of all of the wonderful names that you have gotten to work with, who is your favorite scene partner, living or dead, or someone that just made you a better actor?
I have never been able to answer the favorite question.
Great.
That's from like my favorite meal, my favorite movie, or my favorite scene partner. I honestly, there are too many people. I couldn't pick one out of the thousands I've worked with. I would have to say Bernadette Peters was the last person I worked with on stage.
Yeah.
And she has an indelible place in my heart. Because she was someone that I had known for years and admired and loved. And
never worked with? You had never worked with her before?
No. I mean, we had crossed, in the musical of Cinderella that we did for ABC that Rob Marshall choreographed and Rob Iscove directed. Bernadette played the stepmother and I played, what did I play? Oh, yes,
the king. Yeah.
Oh, Cinderella. Yes, the king. I've done a few of those. And I can't remember which. But that was the one where Bernadette and I sort of crossed paths in the
right,
palace.
But you weren't. Yeah.
But anyway, so to play Horace to her Dolly was basically restored my spirit. Because at the time, I hadn't done anything for so long on stage. And I wasn't sure I could do it. And I'd never thought of myself able to play Horace or thought of playing Horace, really. I didn't really know the show very well.
Yeah.
And then Bernadette and I got together in the first day of rehearsal with Jerry Zaks and everybody else. I just thought, oh, I've come back to where I should.
Right.
I was back where I belonged.
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah. What was preventing you from getting back on stage up until that moment? Just so many other commitments, or?
Well, I was working more in television at that time, and I was doing a series in Vancouver, Legends of Tomorrow, and. I sort of, but I think the only thing I'd done before that was, or the last thing was the Present Laughter. And then nothing really came along that was, to do a play, you have to really want to do a play.
Yeah.
I've never been cavalier about that. I'd rather not work if I can't do something that I really want to do.
What a great attitude. At what point in your career did you develop that? Or is that something that's been instilled in you from a very early age?
I think I was always kind of that way. Whether it was arrogant or not. I mean, I would read things and I would say, I'm just not interested in that. That doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
To some agent's chagrin, I remember when Jeff Hunter, God bless his soul, when I was working with that agency, William Morris Agency, I think it was the William Morris Agency, and Jeff Hunter said, I've gotten I think I can get you a lot of money to replace Raul Julia in Man of La Mancha or something. I think that I could have them. It was Raul, I think. Raul Julia had to replace somebody else. And I said, why would I do that? I mean, just the idea of playing that role, you know, even though it was a great coup for him, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know why, because I wasn't very famous at the time. Anyway, but those kinds of things are, I just was never tempted to participate in, unless I thought, oh, that's a role, you know, Tevye, I would have wanted to do, but not that role. Anyways, I've always had that.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Is that something that you feel like your parents instilled at you at a very early age? That sense of, you know, life is, do what you want to do. Life is so short.
No, I think it was just, I think I'm kind of pretentious and have, you know, my taste level runs high, and not that Man of La Mancha isn't a great musical. No. It is a great musical. I don't mean that at all.
No,
but I just know for me, what I do know what resonates and what doesn't.
Great. Now, when did you first start falling in love with the arts?
Oh, I don't remember a time when I wasn't in love with the arts. I mean, my mother used to play Broadway albums. She took me to see West Side Story when I was about 12, I think. We drove to Toronto. We were in London, Ontario, and that was the national tour of West Side Story. I think Cheetah Rivera was doing the tour. I could be wrong.
Oh, wow, okay.
You can check that, but I don't remember that specifically, because I didn't really know who she was until the movie of West Side Story.
Sure.
I mean, until the Broadway, until I had really listened, not the movie, the Broadway, she wasn't in the movie, the Broadway production. Anyway, all I can tell you is that it was life-changing to see that production. And I knew that something was ignited in me. I you know, I also saw the touring company of Milk and Honey.
Oh, my gosh.
Jerry Herman, which I loved. And I grew up in a small town where there was a children's theater that I was a part of when I was very, very young. And I played Tom Sawyer, and I started very early.
So it seems like your parents were very supportive of you getting into the arts. And, you know, there's a difference between doing it as a child and then making it a career. Were they supportive as you went that way as well?
You know, my mother was a very talented singer. And she also had her own television show when I was growing up in London, Ontario, At Home with Hope Garber. It was the name of the show.
Yes. And what was that exactly?
Well, exactly. What was that? It was a homemaking show, and she was not a good homemaker. She was terrible at keeping a house together, but she was very attractive and smart and personable, and she could, you know, interview people, and she did. And she was beloved in London, Ontario. And she encouraged me, I think, because I was fulfilling a dream that she never quite fulfilled. My father wasn't as supportive, but my father, you know, sent me money when I was 16 when I moved away from home.
Yeah.
And I moved to Toronto. Yeah, I left school, and I went to Toronto to become a folk singer. And my father, who was very worried about it, but he would send me money every week to pay the rent in this little boarding house I was staying in.
And would you had a guitar and you were like playing coffee shops? I mean, yep. Is that the sort of idea?
Exactly.
That was what was going on in Greenwich Village in the 60s. And so I imagine that was the same thing sort of seen in
Toronto. Yes, in Toronto it was called Yorkville. And if you watch any of those documentaries on Laurel Canyon and Joni Mitchell and Gordon Lightfoot and Bruce Coburn and all these well-known, I don't know if you'd know all these names, but you would know Joni Mitchell, of course. And they all frequented those clubs. I was never in that league, but I was sort of on the periphery.
But that was the goal, was that sort of that world that the...
You know, it was
at the time.
It was performing. I just needed to perform because that was all that meant anything to me. I mean, in those days, it was to fill that aching hole in all of us. But, you know, I've been able to do that with other things as I've grown older. Right. And it's not as, I don't feel, as it's not as crucial to me now.
Yeah. Sure. And so this also, and I mean, the sugar shop that you were a part of gained a lot of popularity, I would say.
Yeah.
So
we recorded the Centennial Song of Canada, which was sung by a bunch of children. And at that time, the person I was working with, Peter Mann in Toronto, we put a group together and we recorded his arrangement of this kid's song, like as the Mamas and Papas, because we were two men, two women, kids really, young people. Peter was older than all of us, but we were a young group ish. And I was 18, I think, when I and we got an album. We got a record deal from Capitol Records to record an album and a New York manager. And we were a lounge act, basically.
Okay.
And we played Playboy clubs and we were on the Ed Sullivan Show and the Johnny Carson Show. It was what I thought my life was going to be until I realized it wasn't what I wanted.
Such a amount of fame at such an early age. Were you able to keep yourself grounded, or did you start to have, you know, ideas of something greater that was going to come along?
I never felt famous. We were playing in the Playboy Club in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. You don't feel famous there.
Right.
You know, you just, but we did play Vegas a couple of times. And still, I never felt we were famous. I felt like we were a good group and we had a career and we had a record album and a sort of a semi-hit record. I realized at a certain point that wasn't what I wanted to do. And I think when I would go to the theater and I went to Stratford, Ontario and saw, you know, Brian Bedford and Maggie Smith and, brilliant Canadian actors that you would, Douglas Rain and Martha Henry and all these fantastic actors. And I thought, oh, I think that's what I want to do. Really.
So how did you make the leap from being a folk singer into going into that world that was inhabited by those people?
It's hard to sort of trace that. I don't know how conscious all of this is. It was, it kind of just fell into my lap, a lot of it, honestly. I was touring with a musical group called the Canadian Rock Theatre. And we were doing a musical, songs from Jesus Christ Superstar, Godspell, and other original songs. So Godspell was already in the world, and Jesus Christ Superstar was already in the world. And I was touring with this group, and I was playing Jesus in this sort of faux concert thing.
Yes, right.
And as it turned out, we were stopped. There was an injunction placed on us because we weren't allowed to do it. And
shocking.
The people that were producing it were crooks. And
right.
But so we were. So we did make an album. And
Collectors.
On that album, I sang. I think I sang "Save the People," or maybe I didn't sing it, but I was singing it in concert anyway. So I came back to Toronto, and there was an audition for the musical of Godspell. And then that was sort of the big change in my life because I went in and, you know, walked on the stage with my huge halo of curls, gold curls, and had my guitar and sang "Save the People." And, you know, I guess it was impressive because I had been doing it for a year. So I knew how to do it. And I had a really, at that time, I could really hit the notes that I could never hit again. But and so I got the role. And as you know, that's a famous group of people.
Can you tell us who was who were your co-stars in this?
It's Gilda Radner, Martin Short, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Jane Eastwood, who's very well known in Canada, but she's a star in Canada. And they would be the people that you would most know. And Paul Schaefer was the musical director.
This is an illustrious.
Yeah, insane.
What were some of the any memories of putting that show together with this incredible group of talent?
More memories than I could even fill this podcast with. All I can tell you is that Marty and I are very close, and Andrea, Eugene, we're still incredibly close, and we all knew at the time that we were a part of something much greater than ourselves. But we all knew, I definitely knew that I was surrounded by some of the most talented people. I felt completely inferior to all of them, except I could sing. And they were the funniest people I've ever known.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know them beforehand? Had you no, interacted with them?
Everyone's
the
new.
The final callback for Godspell. We all met.
So speaking of callbacks and auditions, do you like the process of auditioning?
Do I like the process of auditioning? That's,
do you like to audition?
No. I don't know anybody who likes to. I mean, I like to audition if I feel that I'm prepared and I can play the role. If I don't know kind of what I'm doing, and oftentimes, I mean, I'm trying to think of what I auditioned for early in my career that I got. I think Death Trap was okay. One thing. Ghosts was one of my yep. Ghosts was long before anybody knew who I was. The Waltz of the Toreadors with Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, yep. Which was my first play that I did in America, yep. That Brian Murray, rest his soul, directed. And I had to audition for that. But I think, you know, in those days, actually, you know, Ellis Rabb, the theater people that I worked with, some of the greats in the theater, and Ellis never auditioned anybody. He just, oh, you're perfect. You're perfect. I don't need to audition. He was one of those guys.
It's so funny you say that. Before we interviewed you, we just interviewed Barry Boswick, who had worked with Ellis Rabb, and was saying the exact
same thing.
So let's talk a little bit about some of those people that very early on in your career just trusted you, that said, you're very talented, we believe that you can do this. And how did that mentorship, you know, impact your career? Maybe we can take Ellis Rabb as an example.
I was doing, I'll tell you, one of the great sort of supporters, it was is Anne Roth, the great costume director.
Oh yeah.
She did a Hallmark Hall of Fame that was shot in Toronto, and I was still living in Toronto, and I played Lafayette opposite Richard Basehart in this this very highfalutin, and Chris Walken was in it, and John Hurd was in it, and all these incredible people. As I think back now, and Anne Roth dressed me, costumed me for that, and we just had this great time together. And then I came to New York, and I was testing for the role of Roberta Muldoon in The World According to Garp, and so that was in New York. By that time, I had come to New York, and she said, "You have to meet Ellis Rabb and Jack O'Brien." She said, you have to meet, that you have to work with those people. And she set it up, and I ended up working with both of them and subletting Jack O'Brien's apartment in New York. And Anne Roth really started me in the theater.
That's what a wonderful story. What a wonderful story, that idea of just pushing somebody out to connect them. Now, when did you go from playing Jesus in, you know, Toronto and Canada to coming to New York City? What was the impetus behind that move?
I guess it was the movie of Godspell. Mm. I was cast almost, like, I only played it for like 3 or 4 weeks in Toronto. And I was taken out and... I was suddenly living in New York, making the movie. It was crazy. And once I got there, once I was doing that, the cinematographer's girlfriend, Sally Sapphire, said, "You have to meet my brother, Bruce Savan." And Bruce Savan was one of the most important theatrical agents in New York at the time. And he was with an agency, I think, it was APA eventually, yeah. But it was before that, it was something else. And he signed me. And the next thing I knew, I was doing the Waltz of the Toreadors. I think that was the first thing I did.
With Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson?
Yep.
What is it like being on stage with these two titans of theater?
It was a glorious experience. It was, I remained friendly with them until they, long into their later years. And not that we saw each other, but whenever we did, it was like family, or as they would say, mishpucha.
Yes.
That was, I think, the term that you would use. Yes. And they were, they were just, it was a delight to be in a play with them. We played the Philadelphia Drama Guild, I think, Drama League or something. It was in, so, and then we did then we went to Palm Beach and did it there. And then they did a tour, which I didn't do. But everyone of those people had a huge influence on me. Just their professionalism, their love of the theater, their history. I was young, and I was not educated. So this was my education.
So being in the trenches, listening from the people that were there, was how you were getting this education.
Yeah.
That is
doing it.
Basically, I'm trying to think of the sequence of events, but Ghosts was a big turnaround for me at the Roundabout Theater when it was under a supermarket on 26th Street. That's where the original one of the original Roundabout where it was. I think it was one other place before that. Jean Feist was the artistic director, and Beatrice Straight. Was an actress that a lot of people don't know about, but she won the Oscar for Network.
Yeah,
and she was a very wonderful. She was a society woman who was a really gifted actress, and she had this. She was the most generous. She adopted me pretty much. And I played Oswald and got the Theater World Award, which I didn't even know what that was.
Well, were you actively, pursuing non-musical theater, or was it just sort of, it just happened that you just started going into, no kidding, wow. Because sometimes people get sort of pigeonholed in one or the other, and it's very rare, especially starting out in your career, that you can kind of go Sweeney Todd or Death Trap Sweeney Todd, play music. I mean, that is pretty special. I mean, and the fact that you didn't seek it out, did you eventually want to focus on one or the other, or was it always been both, either or?
It's pretty simple for me in that Sondheim was the reason I really came to New York. I mean, that was sort of my siren when I was, I've told this story, but I listened to Anyone Can Whistle until the record was completely worn out. And so the irony is that I ended up working with Angela and Stephen Sondheim in an original musical that was a life changer for everyone involved. I had a high bar for musicals. Steve was sort of he was it for me.
Yeah.
But my first musical, I'm trying to think, what I do was, what was it in New York? My first musical, I don't know. I can't think which one it was. Maybe it was Sweeney Todd.
I believe it was Sweeney.
Yeah. Because I know that I did Tartuffe at the Circle in the Square, which is also Stephen Porter. That whole group of people. Stephen Porter was a great champion of mine, and I did Shaw and Molière, and that's where I got that training, right, just as I on the day I was doing it. I mean, I learned so much from all of that. And I think Hal Prince said when he saw me in as Valère, was it Valère in Tartuffe, yeah, that he had me in mind for Sweeney Todd.
That's,
I could have that wrong, but I think he did.
That's, yeah, that is absolutely incredible. So all, so your, most people go to school, you know, most people go to college and they have all of this training before they even immerse themselves in this world. You just threw yourself in and you had on the job training, which, yes, is, which is so wonderful. Who were some of the actors at this time that you were either working with or observing as an audience member that were really giving, having a profound effect on what you wanted to eventually create?
When I first came to New York, I did regional theater and the Long, oh, War Theater. That's where I got so much of my training. And also then I went to the Yale Repertory Theater, and that's, and, you know, I was the class after when Merrill had just left, and, you know, and, some other great names that I can't think of. And so, I was seeing great performances, you know, and I was getting this sort of, intense training. So, you know, it was just, I just kind of threw myself into it and didn't really know what I was doing. Most of the actors I watched, I want to say his name is Bill Sweatland. He was a yeah, Long Wharf staple. And I worked with him and John McMartin and Charlotte Moore were also in the Autumn Garden, yeah, which I did that Arvin directed. And, John McMartin, just watching him was like, you know, that was something. George Hearn was also one of the people who worked at the Long Wharf all the time. So I that's where I learned because I knew what was good. I knew what was good and I knew what wasn't good.
Yeah,
and on stage, and I just modeled myself after the people that I, at least, and that was my impression. And you know. I think I'm right.
Absolutely.
They were the greats.
My God. My God, yes. To have worked with any one of those people. So how do you approach a role? You get cast, you start to get to work. What is your process?
To me, it's always on the page. Mm. I just read the script over and over and over, and I sort of psychologically examine what the character is going through. And this isn't, by the way, a conscious, I rarely write anything down in the script. Mm. I realize I don't even underline lines, which, oh, I don't know why. I just don't. I just read the script over and over. And once I have, and I say the lines out loud, mm, I have to hear my voice and I have to hear the tone of my voice. It's in, and I'm sure it's against every Meisner technique or every, I don't know. Because I've never really studied. Yeah. It's all kind of accumulated by osmosis and my own innate talent that was God-given. And I don't know why it is that I honestly don't know how I got to be where I am. It's just a miracle to me that I'm talking about it, because as I'm talking about it, I'm thinking, oh yeah, then I did that. Oh, I forgot I did that. It just seems now at this age, like it was all haphazard, but of course it wasn't. I had a goal. My goal was to be on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I always knew that one day I would be on Broadway. And everyone thought I was insane because I'm, you know, from a small town in Ontario.
But you had such, you believed in yourself. Right? You believed that you had this God-given ability to go out and tell stories, and eventually that was going to come to fruition on a Broadway stage, which, yeah, is a lot about the belief in yourself. At the moments of your life or your career where maybe things were not going in the right direction, how do you keep that positivity? How do you keep that optimism?
I don't always. And then, yeah, I have to figure out a way to regain, or also, well, I think how I do it is that I start to realize what's important, mm, and what I have and not what I don't have. Mm-hmm. How I've been. And also when I see the suffering around me and I see that I don't have that. I mean, I have my own way of, you know, my own things that I feel I'm frightened about. But I don't have to worry about food. I don't have to worry about shelter. And I have a very strong spiritual sort of practice of meditation and it's work every day. It's a reminding myself and what matters.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about what do you look for out of a director? To you, what is the ideal actor-director relationship?
I can name a couple.
Please,
Robert Moore. Robert Moore was one of the great directors I've ever worked with. Nicky Martin, who was my friend, directed me in Macbeth and Present Laughter and The Royal Family, who was one of my great mentors. He was Ellis's, confidant. It was quite a group back then. These people who can make you feel safe in a rehearsal room and who know how to talk, how every actor needs different things and how to somehow assimilate, make you a cohesive group. That's the great director to me.
You know, when you get something on the page or in the rehearsal room, and you go, this isn't working for me. Do you have any problem starting a dialogue with a playwright or with a writer or a director saying this is not
going? I would never presume to do that. I mean, I will go to, you know, if there's a line that I think doesn't quite resonate or make sense, I would bring up. But you know, doing art, for instance, you know, there when the play is great, you don't have to do that, you know. And so, no, I do it in television more than I've never done it in the theater. I've never, you know, tried to rewrite a play. You know, the play is either there or it's not.
But in television and film, you feel like there's the latitude there to,
you know, I take liberties because I'm old and because they, you know, they have to pay attention to me and I scare people now.
Yes.
Great. Use that power. Use it well.
That's right.
How do you like to be spoken to as an actor? How do you best receive direction or feedback?
I like to be told the truth, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if you're doing something that's not working, it's not working. I think you have to. But what helps is if you have a suggestion as to what would be an alternative way of doing it, or, you know. But I haven't really had that kind of problem with directors. Some directors just aren't good at it. They just don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then some directors, I mean, Stephen Porter barely said anything to me. And I got the greatest reviews of my career doing plays that he directed. So,
exactly. And now every role is challenging, but has there been a role specifically that you've taken on that you said, boy, I am really, really, I don't want to say out to sea with this one, but I'm really flexing muscles I haven't flexed before?
Well, I would say Macbeth that kind of stopped me in my tracks. I didn't really ever want to play that role. And Nicholas Martin said, you have to play this role and I'm going to direct you in it. And we're going to go to the San Diego and do it at Jack's Theater. And I said, okay.
Right. Just go along for the ride.
I did it. I mean, I don't think it was particularly impressive, but what was impressive to me was that I got through it and then I did it.
Do you read reviews?
No, rarely. I mean, I came across a couple lately when I was donating like all these boxes of stuff, the stuff I had in boxes to Broadway Cares. And I came across a review of Merrily We Roll Along that I did in at the Arena Stage a long time ago. And it was just open in a file. And I thought, what's this? And I'm like, oh God, that awful production. And then I read this review that Frank Rich wrote, and it was really, and I never read Frank Rich's reviews because he scared me. And he was also, you know, he's brilliant. And it was a very positive review, even though it was terrible for the show. It was very positive for me. And I was like, and I thought, wow, it really made me feel, it just lifted my spirits that day, which it shouldn't, because really who cares, but it did.
It's nice words. It's nice words of validation.
Sure.
Well, hello there. This is Shirley Booth. Oh, I used to be a Broadway baby. Now I'm more of a middle age. But whatever age you are, we can help keep Broadway behind the curtain on the air. Just head over to patreon.com. Oh, sure, get a pencil. That's patreon.com. You got that? Oh, just search Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Set a monthly donation. Oh, even a dollar helps. Oh, sure. Mr. B gives.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Speaking of Merrily, we're going to go on a Sondheim path right now. How does Sweeney Todd come into your orbit?
I can't remember exactly how the audition came through. I think it was through the agency, and it was Joanna Merlin was casting it. Yes. And obviously Hal had called me, wanted me to come in because he had seen me at the Circle in the Square. That's how I remember this sort of, that was sort of the connection. Not that I'd ever met Hal during that time, but I went in and I sang like an Italian art song that I badly, because they wanted something sort of semi-operatic rap, and I was studying with a wonderful voice teacher, and he said, "Oh, sing this," and so I sang it, and I remember hearing all these voices, you know, before me, thinking, "I don't have a chance in this. This is not, you know," I hadn't heard the score, and then I got a callback from that audition, and the callback was to learn a song from the show. And I was to go to Stephen Sondheim's house and learn, hear the song, because I don't read music. So, and I don't think they were sending out music. They were just, I don't read music. So so I took my little cassette recorder on the bus, the Second Avenue bus, and I went to Steve's house. I couldn't believe on the way there that this was happening to me. I remember very clearly thinking, I don't believe I'm on my way to Steve Sondheim's house with my little cassette recorder. And I got there and I was, you know, rang the bell and was let in and sent upstairs. And Steve was in his office upstairs and very nice. Hi, nice to meet you. And so we love your audition. And would you mind recording this song? And I said, oh, I don't know. So I put my, those box cassette tape recorders, and then pressed play, and then I heard those first notes, and Steve sang Joanna into my cassette recorder, and I probably said something like, "That's the most beautiful song I've ever heard," because it was, and And I went home and learned the song and came back, I don't know, a week, maybe less later, and sang it. And Steve still talks about the audition. And I say, you cry at anything. Anytime someone sings your song, you cry at your audition. It was one of the, he talks about it. And he actually recently reminded me of that.
Wow.
And so there I was.
That could have been it right then and there. I mean, to think, you know, you got a Tony nomination before for Death Trap, right? And yep. And then you're making your Broadway musical debut with a piece of Stephen Sondheim's. I'm assuming there were a lot of pinch me moments in the rehearsal process of Sweeney Todd, just going, where am I? And what, how lucky am I?
Yes. It was a crazy, unwieldy show that really nobody knew how it was going to be received. I mean, it was like nothing else that had ever been done, certainly nothing else that I had ever done. However, I was very aware from that it was one of the greatest scores I had ever heard. And in the rehearsal, that just became more apparent every time we did it. And working with, you know, Len and Angela, of course, that's just the thing about it.
No, it's pretty perfect. It's pretty perfect. How long were you with Sweeney Todd for?
A year? Well,
No,
I didn't do it very long. And that was kind of I left and I got out of it a little earlier because I asked to be released for only 6 months. And I didn't do it quite 6 months. I don't know how I got a 6-month contract, but I did.
Okay.
I was very, that's the other thing about things. I think I said I can't do more than 6 months. I don't, you know, and I don't know. I had a lot of chutzpah.
What did you do afterwards?
I had been offered the leading role in their playing our song national tour. And I honestly, at that point, the role of Anthony, I was done. I was too old to play that role. I felt like the role has a great song, mm-hmm. a couple of great songs. And that's about it.
Yeah.
I was bored. I loved the songs.
When you are doing a long run, how do you keep yourself fresh? How do you keep yourself activated?
Well, that's sort of the essence of meditation is that mm-hmm. there is only now. There is only now. This is the only moment there is. So if you're in this moment, then you can't be thinking about yesterday or tomorrow. So if you're in the moment, you're playing the role with every fiber of your being. If you're thinking about how bored I am, you're not in the moment.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's easier said than done, by the way.
Of course. Going back to Sweeney Todd for a second, tell us a little bit about being directed by Hal Prince, what that experience was like.
That was very, very different. That was, Hal was sort of like the great producer. He was like, I imagine what, it was not specific. It was all about spectacle and
big picture.
I mean, he was very smart. He was a genius and a great editor and storyteller. But, you know, in terms, if you were having trouble, he wasn't the best person to guide you through an acting problem. And I didn't have any acting problems. So I didn't require, I mean, I knew what the role was.
Sure.
It was pretty obvious. And, but he was, I mean, and by the way, Angela and Len were, you know, but I mean, he had, that was his focus.
And of course.
That's, you know, that was, and Steve was there too.
Yeah.
So it was definitely, you know, a group effort. And, but Hal was incomparable and like no one else I've ever worked with. Hmm.
One of the cool things that, you know, we were talking about before we even went on the air is because your resume is so diverse and in times of the roles that you play, to go from Sweeney to they're playing our song to Little Me. I mean, it's there's such a range there. Do you prefer one style over the other?
No, I think what I do, I love comedy. Noises Off was, it was a really hard show to do. But my God, hearing laughter like that.
Yeah.
They're playing our song. I did that. That was the longest run I ever did because I did the tour and then I came back to Broadway and did it. And that was like I remember when Bob Moore came to see me on the road and I was so proud because I nailed every laugh that was possible. And he said, you've done it. You've lost the guy. Just lost them. He said, all you're doing is getting the laughs. He said, you've lost. Oh. And that was a huge lesson.
Because
I respected him to the utmost. And he was right, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a
Judith.
Very...
Judith Ivy and I always called each other laugh whores. She said, "I'm a bigger laugh whore than you are." And I said, "I don't think you are. I don't think you are."
I'd love to see the two of you go at that. So let's talk about Noises Off for a little bit, which is this incredibly complex machine of a show.
Yeah,
yeah.
Had you seen it in London prior to joining the company?
You know, this story is kind of a tale, but yes, I had accepted the con. I said I would do it. I read the play. I thought it was incredible. I didn't know how it was possible to do it, but I said yes to the role, and then I flew to London and saw it. And I saw the second company. I don't remember anyone who was in it, but I remember feeling like I'd made a terrible mistake because I didn't find it remotely amusing. And what it was I was jet lagged and the company wasn't quite up to, and also I've seen a lot of British comedies that I find funnier in America than I do in Britain. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes they're not, sometimes, you know, I didn't find it amusing. And so I was in a panic.
Yeah.
And then I got into rehearsal and Michael Blakemore was he was a gentleman and a great director. And also the cast was, you know, Deborah Rush, Dorothy Loudon, Paxton Whitehead, Linda Thorson, Dougie Seal, Amy Wright, Jim Piddock. I can't believe I got all those names.
I know. I was about to look it up.
and that was an ensemble.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, I don't think there's been a much better cast than that. I really don't.
I have to say, and I hope this isn't, you know, I hope I don't get arrested. Somebody recently sent me a bootleg of the original cast of Noises Off. And watching all of you work, it is just beautiful. The ensemble nature of it is just beautiful and seamless. How did you build that ensemble? Was it just through the rehearsal process, or was there? Yeah,
yeah. It was. They rehearsed the first act to a point of utter tedium, because the first act sets up everything, and everything has to be meticulously set up because it's such a brilliant mathematical piece of work.
Yeah,
I mean it's like an architect at his finest, and Michael Frayn, the writer, is a genius, and so it was. We rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And then slowly, then we moved on I don't think we did the second act. Well, yeah, the second act. The second act was the hardest thing to do because that was the backstage. But because we had rehearsed the first act so completely, it all kind of made sense. It was devastating, and the weird and horrific sidebar to this story is that it was during the AIDS epidemic, and my friend. Who was my understudy and they're playing our song, Oren Reilly, was dying of AIDS in my apartment. It was crazy. And after about 3 months of that show, I was running because in those days I didn't get a car to drive me home. I was taking the 104 bus up 8th Avenue, and I was running for the bus. It was the middle of winter, and I slept in. Broke my foot, and I was out of the show for like 6 weeks. So that was quite a time.
What a time.
Yeah.
What a time. And you were with it for a year. That's a...
I didn't... Oh, yeah. Those 6 to 8 weeks I was out. Yeah.
And I mean, just think about, you know, all the joy, though, that you were able to bring people during that time. I can't.
My life was sort of the laughter and then the horror.
You know, we talk, one of the main reasons we also started this podcast was to really celebrate the individuals that we lost way too soon because of this plague. And in addition to the gentleman that you just mentioned, is there anybody else from that era that had a massively profound effect on you that you wished more people were familiar with or a name that you'd love to get back out of there?
Oh, I couldn't even begin to think of the number of people that had an impact on me that we lost. But Oren Reilly was, one of the funniest, most brilliant guys, and had a knowledge of the theater that was sort of astonishing, and really became my best friend. He was my understudy. My standby, not my understudy, and they're playing our song on the road. And he kind of got me through that year on the road because it was, it was odd to be.
Yeah.
I was just a different world. Touring. I'd never toured.
An actor that you got to work with a few times that we love talking about on this podcast and we wish we could have got him as a guest was Philip Bosco. Can you tell us?
I miss him all the time. I think about him all the time. We were a team. We were a team. I loved him with every fiber of my being. I loved acting with him. I loved having dinner with him. I love his family. And he was so eccentric. And, you know, he had a whole phobia, you know, about the whole below 14th Street. He would only work below 14th Street and then he wouldn't drive anyway. He had all these kind of phobias. And I think they were, you know, eventually diagnosed and he was taking medication and everything. And he got better so he could, you know, finally get, because he didn't work on Broadway for years. And then, he wouldn't fly. He had to drive. He did a movie in LA, he had to drive, he drove to LA. He was a consummate actor. And I feel like he made me better. And I know that he felt the same way about me, that we kind of gave each other support and an openness that we both responded to. And I just feel like Death Trap. Devil's Disciple. Lend Me a Tenor, of course, which was the big commercial one. And then the other Shaw, You Never Can Tell.
Yeah.
And Phil came in and walked away with the show in the last act.
What a genius. One of the great things was watching the two of you and Lend Me a Tenor and watching the two of you just play off of each other so brilliantly and beautifully. I'm assuming that a lot of that relationship was already cultivated in the other two productions you had done and you had just been able to bring that into the rehearsal room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that had as much to do with Jerry Zaks, who recognized and who I loved and would work with. You know, I just love working with him. And recently had, of course, the experience on Hello, Dolly, and it reminded me of why I love him so much. Because he's a genius at comedy and basically human nature. And he knew, I think he whipped that play into a souffle.
Yes.
I'll just stop there.
Yes. Yes.
But he saw exactly what that relationship was and mined it to great finesse and to great success. Of course we Phil and I inherently instinctively did that, but it was a combination of everyone.
And it really, really did show. It really showed in the production. What is it specifically about Jerry Zaks that brings you back more and more? Or brings you back so often, I should say.
Well, I hadn't worked with him for years. And I don't know how my name came up for Dolly. I'm sure it wasn't the top of the list, but it worked out. But Jerry and I have always adored each other. And he just, first of all, he and I have a great sense of how important it is to make your points on a stage and move on and to not labor things and to especially in comedy. And I'm right in his wheelhouse with all of that. And then sometimes I have to say, Jerry, I need a little more time here, you know, and he said, darling, no, of course, take your time. No, I don't. And actually I have to say that as he's gotten older and this experience with Dolly, he was so, he directed Bette and David, you know, and then he directed Bernadette and me. I mean, it's like, so, you know, apples and oranges, really. and he allowed us. He did not in any way infuse his preconceptions on us. And both Bernadette and I were so thankful and realized it immediately. And that's why I think our production was so successful, because it was our own.
Yeah. So
it wasn't just redoing it again.
With that brilliant hand of Jerry Zaks. I mean, it's unmistakably a Jerry Zaks production.
Yeah.
Oh,
and Warren Carlyle, by the way.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, Warren Carlyle.
Warren and Jerry, my God, it's a magic team. It's a magic team.
Yes.
You know, the 90s were it feels like you were everywhere in the 90s, movies, television, on stage. But, I mean, you did two Shakespearean actors.
Jack O'Brien.
You did Arcadia and you did Art. And I think the first time I think I got to see you on stage was Damn Yankees with in 1994. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Applegate and that experience.
Jack lives in San Diego, or lived in San Diego, and I had done two Shakespearean actors with Jack, and I've known Jack most of my life, as I said, my New York life. I was doing Tartuffe and The Importance of Being Earnest, I think that's when it was all happening. And Jack started talking about Damn Yankees, and that he'd rewritten the role, and he'd written the show, and blah, and he gave me what he'd written, and I said, Jack, this is really great. Because, you know, the book for Damn Yankees is troubled. It has great elements to it, but the book is kind of all over the place.
To get you to the next song, really.
Basically.
Sort of. But
Jack had and Jack is really brilliant. And anyway, so we agreed that I would do this, and Beebe was on board, and we were going to do it in San Diego. And then bring it to Broadway, and we did it. And Rob Marshall was the choreographer, and that was when I first met Robbie and Kathleen, who was his assistant. And we fell in love, and we still are in love. Then I did, I did Annie with Rob and Cinderella, which he choreographed, and then Annie the movie for ABC, which was one of the best experiences I've ever had.
Why?
Because it was so good. Because Robbie is masterful. I mean, you know, he. I think he told the story in a way that I think it's really one of the best versions I've seen.
Yeah, he is a special artist. That is for sure. I wanted to ask you about another ensemble that you worked with, which was the Company of Art. Alan Alda, Alfred Molina. One of the best things I've ever seen on a stage.
One of the best things I've ever been a part of. I can honestly say that. That was a highlight of my career, really.
I mean, this play, the tones ranges so much in this, and it was so beautifully done. How did the three of you form your ensemble together, and what was the rehearsal process like?
Alan Alda.
Oh yeah.
Alan Alda said, and I was so like, I don't know about this. He said the only way this play will work is if we spend a lot of time together, the three of us, just off stage, like dinners, and come to Watermill for the weekend. And when someone says that to me and I don't really know them, I'm like, oh no. I'm sorry. I'm not interested.
Right.
Cut to a week later. Alan, when are we going out to dinner again? Alan, when can I come to Watermill again? I mean, it was insane how much we loved spending time with each other. Yeah. And it was insane. And we, every night before, and Matthew Warchus, the great Matthew Warchus, who is also a director who I would kill to work with again. And I know we've talked about doing something and it never works out or hasn't worked out, but maybe it will. But he encouraged us to do this and he guided us through, but Alan, we every night before have an hour before the show, we would all meet and we would sit backstage and we would talk about our day. And we would make each other laugh, and or explain something that was painful or something, and we would take it to 5 minutes, go to our dressing rooms, and then come on stage every night.
Wow,
that's incredible.
Wow,
and it was I know the impact that had on me, and I know the impact it had on people in the audience, and. You know, I just feel like I was so fortunate to be a part of it. And I adore both of those men. I still am in touch with them. I don't see them enough, but they're very much in my heart.
Oh, my God. An absolutely beautiful, beautiful production. Mm-hmm. And so when we get done with this quarantine, do you want to get back on stage?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't really talk about the play because it's.
No, that's fine.
You know, it's too off a year from now. But
sure.
There is a play that I'm, you know, in the supposed to do with some great people. And it's a really interesting new play. And I hope we can do it. I hope we can do it. But, you know, it's we'll get there eventually. But,
yeah. In the interim, how do you keep yourself artistically fulfilled?
Yeah.
While we're all waiting to get back?
Well, doing this has helped me because I remember that I actually have something to offer.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I do a lot of videos for, you know, to raise money for things. And I've been doing, and, you know, I've been doing publicity for this movie, Happiest Season, which is now.
It's great. Victor, it's wonderful. It's really wonderful. I loved it, actually. I we were watching all holiday films, and then there you are. And it's really lovely.
It's
really
very lovely. Sweet.
It is.
Yeah, I'm very, very proud of it and proud to be a part of a gay-themed Christmas movie that really is touching for families of any family.
Exactly.
And so, So I've been talking a lot about, you know, I do what I do. And now we're, you know, I've decided to move in a pandemic. So that keeps me very busy.
Yes.
It's going to be great. It's going to be just fine.
So imagine you can talk to the young version of yourself that's coming from Canada to New York for the first time, about to start the career. What do you know now that you wish you had known then? What advice would you pass on to your younger self?
You don't need to worry as much. You can just enjoy your life, which it's taken me a long time to really understand what that means. But honestly, I wouldn't change anything. Anything.
Yeah.
Because everything I did made me who I am and brought me to where I am today. So it's kind of, I've always thought, I wouldn't have done anything different.
Yeah. I think that's such beautiful advice. And it seems, and please, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like you were able to create this beautiful legacy of work on your terms.
Yeah.
What made you happy? What challenged you? And that's just a rare gift for so many artists. So thank you for setting that example for so many.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. And yeah, I feel grateful that I somehow had that within me to, I think, you know, it's really important for young artists to know when to say no.
Yeah.
Say no. Yes. You don't have to do everything. You have to work and you have to study. But you do things that aren't always ideal. But if it's something that inherently doesn't make sense to you, unless you find it a challenge, like an acting challenge that you think is worth doing, you know. But I everything for me is on the page. And if it's not on the page, then I have to consider why I would do it.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And often it's for the money. And then I'm always, most of the time, sorry. But I do it because it renovates the apartment, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Victor, thank you so, so much for your time. And thank you so much for all the wonderful
really appreciate things it.
You've given us. Till next time, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye, folks.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and a big thanks to the punchy players Jeff Marquis, who is bringing back Lucy, Betty, Judy, and Morda shill for us.
And a big thanks to our sound editor Daniel Schwartzberg and social media manager Bethany Ann Selecki.
And don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you come in.
In order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us just 1 star and you can make us feel as bad as Annie did in that really weird production in Boston where Annie dreamt that she was being adopted, but then she ended up back where in the orphanage, right back where she started. Yeah, true story. Rob saw it.
Yes, and it was Betty. It was bizarre. I was there. I was.
Oh, good.
So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details. of Sunset Boulevard.